The Bishop Museum in Honolulu first opened its doors back in 1891. Located in Honolulu, the museum is Hawaii's preeminent destination place to discover and learn about Hawaii and Polynesia's cultural past. There are also equally engaging hands-on interactive experiences for young and old alike at the museum's Science Adventure Center. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Bishop Museum's historian, DeSoto Brown, as he talks story about the museum's past, present, and future.
My name is DeSoto Brown, and I am the Bishop Museum historian, and we are speaking from Bishop Museum archives at Bishop Museum in Honolulu, Hawaii.
You've been here, what, 30 years now?
I've been here just about 30 years. Next year will be my 30th anniversary here at Bishop Museum.
Bishop Museum is an extraordinarily beautiful historic structure itself, a part of this museum that's been here 118 years.
We just passed our 125th anniversary.
And yet, it's not on a main drag. It's off on a side street. So it's a place that you have to either know about or be told about or seek out.
That's exactly right. And the reason Bishop Museum was built where it is, which, as you said, is nowhere near Waikiki, which is where most tourists stay when they come to the island of Oahu, is because this originally was the campus of the Kamehameha Schools. And there is a historic connection between the Kamehameha Schools and Bishop Museum. Something that's important to note is that while Kamehameha Schools receives a substantial income from land which originally belonged to Bernice Pauahi Bishop, and it was her will upon her death in 1884 that started the schools, Bishop Museum was started by her husband after her death in her memory, but it gets no income from the substantial amount of land and investments that the schools have. So the schools were built on this property because it was scenic, and it was also property that already belonged to what was then called the Bishop Estate, and the museum became sort of an add-on to the schools. And as time passed, the school moved away to a new campus, and the land became that of Bishop Museums. And one thing that's very interesting was that, as you mentioned, it does seem to be out in the middle of nowhere, kind of, although it's all urbanized, obviously, in the city of Honolulu. Originally, the property was much different, and as Honolulu has urbanized around this property, it has been very drastically affected by things like the traffic pattern. The H1 freeway was constructed through what had been part of the property in 1959 and onwards. So what we're left with today is only a small section of what originally were very expansive grounds. Even so, even though it is, as I said, much reduced, it is quite a beautiful spot.
Let's go back in time for a moment. When it was built, when it was brand new, give us a visual picture of the lay of Honolulu. This could likely have been a real icon visually at the time.
Yes, it was. When the Bishop Museum first building was constructed, which was from 1890 to 1900, and we say it's the Hawaiian Hall complex, it looks like one large building, but it's actually three buildings built in succession. It was situated in a prominent spot on the grounds of the Kamehameha School, at the top of the hill, at the highest point of the grounds, and you would have approached it originally from a point below, and you would have gradually wended your way up through the school buildings to approach this magnificent structure at the top of the property.
Castle-esque.
Yeah, very castle-like. The outer part of it is cut stone, which was quarried right here on the grounds. It does look magnificent. Even today, it's very imposing looking, and it's something that it would be irreplaceable. You could never build another building like it today. And yes, at the time, the Bishop Museum was located far away from what was then downtown Honolulu, located next to Honolulu Harbor. And Honolulu Harbor developed as the center of the city because it was where the ships came and went. Before there were Western-style sailing ships, it hadn't been a very important thing, but once those ships began to come here, starting in 1778, they needed a harbor. They needed a deep draft harbor, which would be deep enough for them. And thus, the city of Honolulu grew from where it is today. And now, of course, all the space that had been open between what's now downtown Honolulu and Kalihi area where we are now is long since filled in entirely. Honolulu is now a very densely populated city, much more dense than a lot of cities in the rest of the United States, I might add, because there's not a lot of space here. But Honolulu has grown towards and surrounded what originally was not necessarily rural, but an area far removed from the rest of town.
When Bishop envisioned this museum, talk to us about his philosophy and his passion and why he did what he did.
Well, Charles Reed Bishop was a man from the United States. He was from Glens Falls, New York. He came here with a friend of his, William Little Lee, in 1849, 1850. They traveled across North America to go to the Gold Rush in California and then decided they would keep going and come out here to the Hawaiian Islands from San Francisco. At that time, Hawaii was a separate country. The Hawaiian Islands were the Kingdom of Hawaii. They were ruled by royalty. And Charles Reed Bishop met a young woman who was a descendant of the royalty, which at that point, that dynasty was ruling the Hawaiian Islands. It was the Kamehameha family, Kamehameha line. And Charles Reed Bishop and Bernice Pauahi Bishop fell in love and were married. And this type of relationship of a Caucasian man from the United States marrying a Hawaiian woman was actually fairly common at the time.
You might add that she was stunningly beautiful.
She was stunningly beautiful, and she had also been educated at what was called the Chief's Children's School, which started in 1839, which was run by American missionaries, but it had been created at the request or the demand of some of the ruling chiefs of the island of Oahu, because they realized that the youth, the young royalty, the members of royalty, were at that point going to be facing a time when they would be dealing increasingly with the outside world, and they had to know how to deal with foreign people, to know foreign customs, to be able to communicate. So the Chief's Children's School, run by American missionaries, as I said, was run entirely in English. So Bernice Pauahi Bishop and her compatriots, who were all Hawaiian, spoke English fluently, wrote in English fluently. And in fact, when they wrote letters to each other and wrote diaries, they wrote in English because that's how they'd been educated.
As I recall, she studied French too.
Oh, absolutely. And it was always emphasized, particularly for the women of this royal class, that they should emulate how royalty was taught in Europe and also what well-bred young women did at that time. So what did you do? You not only learned languages, you learned history, but you also, you know, learned to play the piano and you learned how to sew and things like that. So she was very well brought up in the sense of how an American or European young woman, well-to-do and or nobility, would have been educated. So she had no problem communicating with her future husband. Obviously, they were able to speak English to each other. And they were married, as I said, and they were truly very much in love. And she was, interestingly, her chosen title during her lifetime was Mrs. Bishop, nothing denoting her royal status. She, at the death of King Kamehameha V, which was in 1871, as I remember, she was called to his deathbed, literally, just shortly before his death, and he said, I want you to be my successor, to be the next ruler. And she said, no, do not think of me, choose someone else. She didn't want the responsibility. And yet, she also very strongly felt the responsibility of taking care of people, because that was something that was very emphasized for the Hawaiian nobility. You are caring for your people. You don't get to just order them around. They look to you for the guidance, but you also have to care for them. And so she was very aware of the need and the desire to help her people. A year before her death, she inherited a tremendous amount of land from her cousin, Princess Ruth Keʻelikolani. And then the following year, as she became ill with cancer, she and her husband, Charles Reed Bishop, discussed various things, obviously, about her estate. And two things came out of that. One was that her will was written, which specified that all of the income from her land was to go to a school, giving preference to Hawaiian children, and that Kamehameha school system is obviously with us today, fortunately. The other thing was that she and Charles Reed Bishop had traveled to the United States and to Europe, and they had seen in their travels museums. And there was some preliminary discussion between the two of them about potentially starting a museum of some type. After her death in 1884, Charles Reed Bishop began the process of not only putting into effect her school that she wanted according to her will, but also a museum in her memory. And gradually that grew from being sort of a memorial structure, which would just display some relics, into an actual functioning museum. And by the time Charles left Hawaii permanently in 1896, Bishop Museum was up and running, largely through the efforts of a man named William Brigham, who was the first curator and the first director of the museum. They were actively collecting, they had buildings been built, and there were exhibits and displays, and that was the foundation of what the museum still is today.
Is it encyclopedic in context of Hawaiiana?
It is not only a cultural museum, but it's a natural history museum as well. And our focus primarily is the Hawaiian Islands, but the rest of the Pacific and in its entirety. So we have collections that are not only the people of the Pacific Ocean, and when I say the Pacific, I am excluding North America, South America, Asia, Australia for the most part. We focus instead on the three cultural groups of the Pacific, the Polynesians, the Melanesians, and the Micronesians, but also the plants and the animals and the insects and the sea creatures of this area, too.
And this was all original, out of the chute, his vision?
It was not necessarily Charles Reed Bishop's vision initially, but it came to be his vision, I think, with the influence of William Brigham.
Very interesting. So it opened its doors in
1891.
And it was open to the public, and it advertised and promoted people within the community, within the islands, to come here.
That's absolutely right. Although, for a long time, the public aspects of the museum were subservient to the research aspects of the museum. And so we can say up until the 1950s, there were exhibits, but they didn't get a heck of a lot of attention. Much more attention was given to active collecting, active dissemination of information through Bishop Museum Press, explorations or expeditions that went to places and collected not only objects, but natural history specimens and information as well. And starting in the early 50s, we got a new director who said, we are going to need to not only continue doing those things, but we have to get a buy-in, or we have to get support from the community, because they are the people who can give us money to keep us going. So there was much more outreach starting at that point to actively bring people here and to change exhibits so that we're not just static. In other words, if you'd been once, you didn't need to go back. Well, that's when they began to say, okay, let's change things. And that's also when we got a membership organization, the Bishop Museum Association, in order to get people to feel like they had a connection to the museum, to not only be donors, but to come to it, to talk about it, to get other people to come here, just general support. And that's where we still are trying to do what we were doing way back then, to get more people to come and to spread information. All those same things are still happening.
Talk to us about the here and now, what somebody would see, what they would experience, and some of the highlights, places you would first take me to go, you got to see this.
Absolutely. Well, the major sort of focus of the visitor experience on the Bishop Museum campus is, as I said earlier, the Hawaiian Hall complex, and that's our historic-looking building that has this magnificent appearance to it. And it basically is the same building, the same structures as were constructed in the 1890s. It's all been refurbished. We did a major renovation, and we installed all new displays throughout that complex starting from 2007 to 2013. And all of that's been redone. So you've got a fabulous new experience with all new controlled lighting, controlled environment, all new exhibits, tremendous amount of work that we did. And I was on the committee that worked on that for that whole time of rethinking, what are we trying to tell people? What are we trying to get across to people? And that is all cultural. So that's all human-related material. And in Hawaiian Hall, we focus on Hawaiian culture. In Pacific Hall, we talk about the other Pacific cultures. We have a changing exhibit space, which is called the Long Gallery. We have what's called the Picture Gallery, which is an art gallery, essentially. And it's all within this amazing, wonderful structure, which of itself, as I commented to you earlier, is essentially our biggest artifact. Also on the campus, we've got the Castle Building, which is where we have changing exhibits. And so you may know that there is a sort of a circuit of changing exhibits that travel around throughout the museums of not only the United States, but other countries too. We have a succession of traveling exhibits that come through and are placed in the Castle Building, which are always going to be different than what we are doing elsewhere. And it's going to be things that Bishop Museum doesn't have in its collection. It's going to be things that you're not able to see in the rest of what we've got here. And then finally, there is the Science Adventure Center. That's focused on science. That's focused on natural history. And in the Science Adventure Center, as well as the exhibits that we create in-house, we always are doing a lot of hands-on stuff. So it's no longer a static museum where you walk in and look at things on the wall and you don't touch anything. Nowadays, you've got to have things that people touch. And while these are aimed at kids, of course, adults do them too and enjoy them as well. So it's a different type of museum that existed, say, 50 years ago. Nowadays, you actually are involved by touching.
I noticed walking in the front entry to the right, there's an observatory.
Yeah, and there is also a planetarium, and I neglected.
That's what I meant, the planetarium.
Yeah, and I neglected to mention the planetarium, which has a small planetarium dome. We have changing planetarium shows in there, and they are run on a regular schedule starting in the afternoon, and then we have a lot of evening shows as well. So not only do we have, here's the sky, here are the stars, etc., there are other things that go on in there too, because you can project up against the ceiling. So there sometimes are things for kids, for example, for like Halloween last year, we had this Halloween show in which funny pictures of monsters were displayed up inside the dome of the planetarium. And getting kids engaged through things which are educational but also fun is another really important thing that this museum does and everybody's got to do in the museum world now.
Talk about some of the coolest tactile hands-on experiences for kids here.
One thing that we did in the reconstruction and the renovation of Hawaiian Hall was to create a hands-on area there. And two of the things that I can tell have always been really popular with people. We've got two video monitors, and you can touch those to get those started. They show you a person performing a simple Hawaiian chant. And then in front of you are the traditional Hawaiian instruments that you use in the course of doing this chant. And when you go into Hawaiian Hall, you always hear people listening to those chants, watching those chants, and using. You hear the sound of those implements being used while people are looking at this thing.
So they're playing the instruments.
They're playing the instruments themselves in time to this chant. It's a super simple thing, but the fact that people, ever since it's been present in Hawaiian Hall, have liked it and actively done it. And every time you go in, as I said, you can hear people doing it. That to me is an incredibly uplifting experience because I know people like it and I know they're actually doing it. And again, it's not just kids, it's adults doing it too and enjoying it.
Couple of the coolest things you have on display, historic, you have some cloaks and some incredible Hawaiiana going way back.
We have a number of amazing things in the collection at Bishop Museum, and our largest artifact in Hawaiian Hall is a model of a whale. That whale has always been there from the time it opened in 1903 to the public. The whale has always been there, and that's something that everybody remembers.
It looks contemporary.
And it looks contemporary because, whales don't change, at least not that much. So inside it is a skeleton of an actual sperm whale, and then on the exterior of it is a papier-mâché exterior that looks like a whale. And that's something that, again, it's unlikely that you would replicate that today, but it is this huge, impressive object inside this three-story atrium when you walk in that everybody looks at and is impressed by. And just like everybody else, I remember coming here as a little kid and looking up and seeing that and thinking, what is that huge, wonderful thing? So the whale is really an iconic artifact in Bishop Museum, which we cannot and will not ever tamper with because it's so beloved. As, oh, is the whale still there, is what people say. Yes, we renovated, but the whale is still there. We have other magnificent and marvelous treasures that are very precious to Hawaiian culture.
One of your favorites.
Well, things that I don't want to say these things that people might come and see that they're not here, because the really precious things, the featherwork, for example, those things have to be rotated. You can't leave them on exhibit all the time. So when somebody comes, there may be one certain feather piece, but at another time it may not be there because it's resting. The feather work is one of the highest achievements of traditional Hawaiian culture before pre-contact with the rest of the outside world. And these pieces were made, there were featherwork helmets and there were featherwork cloaks and capes. In other words, short garments on just your shoulders or longer garments that went down almost to the floor.
And these are not recreations.
These are not recreations. These are the actual things. They were made with a sort of a structure, a basic structure of netting of various types, made of various types of natural fibers. And then attached very painstakingly to these structures were bundles of tiny feathers. The Hawaiian birds, which were used for these featherwork pieces, only had, particularly the yellow feathers, which were incredibly prized. The native birds that had them were primarily black feathered, and they only had a tiny amount of yellow feathers. So the birds were caught, the yellow feathers were plucked, and the birds were released. And so the feathers are so tiny that they would have to be bundled together in little tiny little bits, and then those bundles were very painstakingly wrapped onto this structure. When the first Westerners came here, they marveled at these amazing-looking, beautiful feather garments because they'd never seen anything like them before, and to this day they are magnificent and wonderful.
What's the oldest date that you can surmise?
Well, there is one piece which is a long, it's not really a garment. It appears to be just a long strip of yellow feather covered material. And it was used to wrap repeatedly around a person. And that was one of the things that was done in other Polynesian cultures as well. You wrapped mats or other things around you. Didn't make it easy to walk, but it was more of a ceremonial thing to do. This particular piece in oral tradition dated back centuries. And very interestingly, when some feathers fell off of it, they were tested for dating. And in fact, they do date from the time period that the oral tradition said that they came from. And that was a really interesting confluence of modern science and modern techniques being
able. Is that 1700s?
Is what they... 1400s.
1400s. Wow.
Yeah, so that's centuries worth. And as I said, those yellow feathers were so small in number that if you have a cloak with a lot of yellow feathers on it, that would have taken decades to put together because the raw material was so rare just in the first place.
DeSoto Brown, only because of time, we're going to wrap. I'm going to come back and we'll do a walking tour of the Bishop Museum.
Okay. Right.
So, DeSoto Brown at the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. Aloha.
Aloha to you, too, and thanks for interviewing me. And for everybody who's listening, when you're in Honolulu, make sure you come to Bishop Museum. It's really cool. Come to our website, bishopmuseum.org, O-R-G, because that's where you can find out what's happening. You can find out where the museum is. And when you're planning your trip, that will guide you to come to us, and you'll know in advance of what you want to see, and you can see it.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Until we meet again, when Hawaii calls again. This program came from Hawaii.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.